Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 14 of the Playoff Push podcast. I'm Jack Dobbins, and today I'm joined by a very special guest, former general manager of the Colorado Rockies, co-founder of Win Reality, as well as MLB Network analyst, Mr. Dan O'Dowd. How are we tonight?
Jack, how are you? Thank you for being so persistent through your LinkedIn pursuit. I'm proud of you and everything you've done. I'm more than happy to get on here and see if I can answer some questions.
Wow, thank you so much. I really appreciate it. I've, been watching you on MLB Network since probably late elementary school, so it's been a while. And, just hearing you on the TV to now being able to actually talk to you, it's incredible.
Yeah, you're making me feel really old, buddy, but I appreciate that.
All right, let's start off with something that, it's on everyone's mind currently. Of course, you're probably talking about it all the time. What are your thoughts on the postseason so far?
I think the postseason's been great. I love the expanded playoffs. I love to see the passion of the fan bases that we're seeing right now. I mean, I think we're still, learning a lot of lessons. I think momentum going in to the postseason just has a chance to carry through. I think we're seeing some dangerous clubs, and I think some clubs that, put themselves in a position now to have a few upsets.
So funny enough, I'm a Yankees fan that lives in Philly wearing Rockies gear. So I got three different things right there. But I was at game two of Phillies and Mets at CBP, and that
Wow.
Environment was ridiculous.
Great game. Yeah. Must win
Castellanos
game.
walk-off.
Yeah. Must win game for the Phillies. And, they had almost 6 days off because a lot of their regulars didn't play on Sunday. And I just feel like baseball, from a hitting standpoint, is about routines and rhythm and timing, and nothing you can do in that week off, because I've been through it, he replicates any event. And so I thought they would come out and struggle a little bit offensively to hit. And I think the team kind of goes around Bryce Harper. And it's a tough matchup a little bit for me, for the Phillies, because Bryce, for whatever reason, has really struggled to hit in Citi Field. And you could see the home run he hit, like, galvanized the whole team emotionally. But he has historically in his career just not performed very well at all when he's gone on the road to play there.
But when he's at CBP, he's a whole different beast there.
He really is. And so Schwarber, I mean, it's a very deep talented team, but the Mets are playing now with such a high level of confidence and belief, which I think is just a magical tool. It's like a gigantic tsunami in postseason. And the Mets are playing with that right now. They're getting good pitching, clutch hitting. Francisco Lindor is playing like one of the best players in the game. Vientos, who I loved him all year long, has really stepped up. And so I think the Phillies really have their hands full. And I do, at this point in time, if I would not be surprised at all if the Mets won that series.
Yeah, I mean, this Mets team, it may be not a team that people were too excited for entering the year, especially with the disappointment of the previous year. But Lindor really stepped up his game, even from being a good ball player to a great ball player this year, and is helping the Mets, give the Phillies, who people thought were a World Series favorite, a run for their money.
The Phillies didn't end the season real well. They didn't play really well over the last month, certainly the last 3 weeks of the season. You can chalk that up. Clinching early, a veteran team, want to get healthy. But I just believe there's something about teams that play with a high level of mental edge. Like, the Mets have been in a must-win game for 3 months. And I think David Stearns deserves a lot of credit. I thought what he did with the starting pitching going into the season, Jeremy Hefner, their pitching coach, like what he did with Manaea and some of these guys, I think was spectacular. And I thought David made great complimentary moves, like not knowing how good they were at the trading deadline, thinking they maybe were good enough, but not going all in. But the acquisitions of the two, the bullpen's arms that he bought in with Stanek and Maton, and Jesse Winker's been unbelievable in this run. He's unbelievable again today in this game. And so, I mean, I just kind of like where the Mets are at right now. And David Dombrowski's done a great job in Philly. And I thought his trading acquisitions were great too. It's just, they're playing a really hot team right now.
It's definitely the series to look for. You got my Yankees against KC as well. Tigers and Cleveland actually putting up some fights with each other. Class A getting knocked up last night, like giving the Tigers a 3-0 win.
Yeah, that never happens too. I mean, these two teams played 13 times during the season. Cleveland won 7-6. I think more than 50% of those games were one-run games. This was a pick-em series for me. Class A has been unhittable all year long. I did not like his pitch selection to Carpenter. I didn't like the slider there. I would have still continued with four-seamers up. But Kerry Carpenter can hit a fastball. You got to give a lot of kudos for him. That was just tremendous at bat. And Cleveland hits home runs, they win. It's been kind of the story of their season offensively. They didn't hit the ball out of the ballpark in case of Scooble, who, I thought going into this series, Scooble was going to win every game he started, and the Tigers were going to have to figure out a way to win another game to win the series. And so I think game three becomes huge because Cleveland is pitching Alex Cobb, who hasn't been on the mound in a while. I have no idea who the Tigers are going to throw out there. And I'm sure it'll be one of those chaos bullpen games. But I think game three will determine actually who wins this series.
Wouldn't surprise me in the slightest. I believe that home run from Carpenter, from what I saw, was the first home run Class A allowed to a lefty since July of 23, I think I saw.
He just made a really bad pitch. That hit me all over. It had no vertical break. It was very horizontal. It was flat in the zone. Carpenter fouled off some really, really good riding four-seam vertical fastballs prior to that. So I'm sure Class A was thinking, yeah, should I throw this here? But he doesn't shake. A big move in that game was removing Hedges and putting in Naylor because Hedges is an elite game caller. I don't think Hedges calls that pitch there because Class A never shakes. And so I think Hedges would have stayed hard there. So when they pinch hit for Hedges, because he doesn't hit very much, I do think that hurt Class A in that inning.
Yeah, I mean, Carpenter's one of those guys that just really was not known entering the year. Comes out, I believe his OPS plus this year was around 140.
Yeah, when he came back off the IL, he really made that offense go. They were struggling to score runs. I mean, they literally could not score runs. And when he came back, I think that kind of lit a fire under him.
Oh, yeah. And of course, the Dodgers Padres series is going to be what it is. Two incredible teams going at it, Machado and Tatis versus Ohtani and Freeman. It's just going to be an offensive battle from
Yeah,
what
I
we've
think the
seen.
Dodgers are in trouble in that series. I thought going into the series, they're starting pitching right now. I mean, they need Buehler to really step up tomorrow in that game. And he did throw good in his last two starts.
Really
But the
rough
pot.
situation for Bueller though, because I don't know if you saw, but he was, I think, mugged yesterday. Like,
I did not see
yeah, I
that.
think he was robbed of like a $100,000 watch at a horse race or something.
Probably not a place to be on your off day, but that's a shame. But he's a tough kid and he's a great competitor and he's pitched well in big postseason games. But I mean, Michael King was unhittable in his
Oh,
postseason start.
yeah.
He's literally been unhittable almost for 2 months now. And so the Dodgers really have their hands full because I don't think Freeman's going to be able to play. And that puts just incredible amount of pressure on other. They're kind of built with those three guys on their four-legged stools. The three of them, the most important part of their offensive
And
connectivity. And
Mookie hasn't been able to hit anything.
well, I know, but he did get a home run robbed from him. And so, if
Yeah.
that ball goes out, that might change his entire series. Hitting is about confidence, and postseasons are small sample sizes. So, like, he crushed that ball. And I was really upset at the Dodger fans because if a guy can go in your stands and catch a ball, that should not happen. He should have been mugged as soon as he went into the stands. They all should have been trying to get that to that ball before Profar did because it's fair game. That's not fan interference. Fan interference is when you go on the field, but not in the stands. He should have had no chance to catch that ball.
Oh, 100%. 100%.
That would have not happened in Philly.
Oh, no shot. No, the fans
No,
would
that
have
would not have happened in Philly.
fans would be trying to get on the field
They would
anyway.
have got the glove off of his hands before that happened.
We'll definitely go more into hitting confidence later with your win reality endeavors. But let's start off with your MLB, should we say managerial career or executive career?
Sure.
Alrighty, so you started off your career in MLB with the MLB Executive Development Program,
I
which
did.
was a leadership program that only took, I believe, two people per year.
Correct. Yeah. And actually, the year I was in, it was myself and Wendy Selig, who had eventually ended up owning the Brewers once her dad became the commissioner. So we were the two. Louis Kuhn, it's a long time ago, was the commissioner at that time. It was a fabulous experience. I got to live in New York City. I got to work in the commissioner's office. I met a ton of great people. I learned a lot. And what they do out of that is place you on clubs. And so then I started my journey with the Orioles back in 1982. I started at the very, very bottom of the organization in ticket sales. And one thing led to another. So it was another really great experience for me because I got a chance to see how the business side worked. So when I became an executive on the baseball side, I still had a very clear understanding of how revenue was generated within the organization, what all the people did in those particular roles to be able to do that.
Yeah, and then after that, you went to Cleveland and then took your primary job, GM of the Colorado Rockies, for 15 years.
Yeah, I would say though that my time in Cleveland for me was probably the highlight of my career,
Oh,
honestly. I mean,
really?
yeah, it really was. I love scouting and development. If I could do anything in the game, it would be just to focus on scouting and development. I loved every aspect of it. It allowed me to touch the players a little bit more. Every day was a problem-solving exercise, which I was good at, relatively speaking. And we took a Cleveland franchise. Hank Peters was my mentor. He ended up taking me with him to Cleveland when he got let go in Baltimore. And we took over a franchise that never won and rebuilt it from the bottom up. We kind of did the same thing in Colorado too, but we'll get into that in a second.
Actually,
But go ahead. No, go ahead,
no,
Jay.
I thought that was the end of the answer, so I was about to ask the next question.
You know, just to take over that franchise, and you know, we lost 105 games and turned it into when we moved into Jacobs Field, which is Jacobs Field before it became what it is now. And we had a led the consecutive sellout streak. We had those incredibly dominant teams. It was just an incredibly wonderful experience. And then Colorado too, but Colorado was a humbling experience for me. I mean, trying to build, create a roster in when you play, I call it the 52-90 experiment now, which is they're a mile above sea level. Trying to build a competitive roster when everything that I had learned up to my career that worked at sea level did not work
Oh yeah.
in you know, elevated baseball.
Especially with
And
pitching.
well, not really just with
Oh
pitching. I mean,
really?
everybody thinks that, but well, think about it. Hitting is a muscle memory activity. You wrap your brain, the more you see pitches, movement patterns, everything else, the more it becomes autopilot for you. But you have no movement at home in Colorado. Then when you go on the road and you're playing at sea level, the same pitches that you saw in Colorado that you saw as, you know, from fastball, slider, curveball, changeup that didn't move, those same pitches are now moving at the
Oh,
road. So
yeah.
you see, you take the same swing at the same time and you foul the ball off. And so what is truly a physical phenomenon quickly becomes a mental phenomenon. And that's why if you look historically on hitters, the hitter splits between home road and Colorado are the most in the history of the game. And very few players have hit above league average on the road because you're constantly changing environments to hit at home versus to hit on the road. So it's not just the physical phenomenon of playing above sea level and all the physical toll that takes on you, mentally trying to hit on the road. I've had great players basically tell me, I'm just going to kind of shut it down until I get it home because I can't hit on the road. So it was a very challenge. Some of the things I just never expected when I took the job became trying to really became an unbelievable exercise and mental acuity trying to figure that out. I did not win enough there, but I'm exceptionally proud of getting to the World Series there because I'm not sure that's, you know, that's going to be duplicated anytime soon.
Yeah, so I have two questions following up in that, which relate to, points that were made throughout it. But let's start off with that World Series team. 2007, 90 games won, wild card berth, and including a run right to the World Series. Some incredible fan favorite ball players, Holiday, Helton, Tulowitzki. But 14 of the last 15 regular season games were won, as well as a sweep of the postseason until the World Series.
Yeah, honestly, Jack, that whole season we were frustrated that, you know, we added like we when I got there in 2000, our ownership group led by Jerry McMorris, they wanted to win right away. I told them that was a really bad idea because we didn't have an infrastructure in place to support that. But ultimately, you know, when you don't own the team, you don't own the team. So we went out, bought Hampton and Nagel. That was a disaster. And so we finally made a decision that we were going to rebuild the organization and take our lumps along the way, which we did, starting in like 2002, three, four, five, six. I mean, we really drafting, developing that team of the 25-man roster. 19 were all homegrown, so it was a large portion of that roster were signed and developed or Latin American signed out of our academy, and so we were frustrated that year. Clint, myself, our former late president, Kelly McGregor, because we thought we'd be better. And so when we got on that run, I think it was like a validation, like we were good. And our players finally started figuring out they were good. And I still think it would have been a very competitive World Series. Back then they were the Indians. They were up 3-2 in that series and up to win the series. And they blew the lead and then lost the series to Boston. But we had 10 days off then between our sweep of the Diamondbacks and our opener in Fenway Park. And we just had completely gotten flat. There's just no way you can maintain that amount of a layoff and maintain strike throwing capability from a pitcher standpoint or hitting capability from an offensive standpoint. The Red Sox were way more talent club than us, but we were on quite a roll. So I really feel like if the Indians had finished the Red Sox off, I really felt good about our chances of winning World Series that year.
Yeah, a lot of people use that same reasoning to dislike the first round bye in these playoffs.
I agree. I really do. I mean, it's and I don't know what to do about it because the one game playoff, in some ways, you play 162 games, you only get one day. But for the clubs that win their division, it's really a disadvantage to get this much time off to play again.
I totally agree with that. Do you think there were any certain key factors that contributed to that run, and did it affect your future mindsets as general manager?
Well, one, it was a validation that you can sign and develop players to win there. Yeah, there were a couple of different things. Number one, Troy Tulowitzki changed our mindset. We had a really talented team that lacked an edge. He provided that edge. He was a player that played with an incredible edge, and he wasn't afraid to challenge guys that didn't play with that edge. Number two, you need a speed combo there. So Matsui and Willie Taveras ended up adding speed to the power that we had in our corners with Helton, Atkins, Pop, and Holiday. But you can't just have power. You need exceptionally good offensive players that really use your gap-to-gap approach to hit. And then you win through a dominant bullpen there. Jeff Francis had an incredible year
Oh,
as a
yeah.
homegrown starter. Ubaldo Jimenez came up and provided some unbelievable innings, dominant innings for us. But the reality is, to win in Coors Field, I mean, you need pitchers that can give you innings, but you need a completely dominant bullpen. We had Brian Fuentes, Manny Corpus, Matt Hergis, Jeremy Atfeld, LaTroy Hawkins. We just had an incredibly deep, talented bullpen, and it really Clint did a masterful job of like doing kind of what the Tigers are doing right now, is just getting the starters to give him a chance to get to his bullpen. So it was a good form of that work. Honestly, Jack, looking back at all that, I'm not sure there's a magical formula to win there. We had a good run. 08, we took a step back. 09, we got into postseason again. The Phillies beat us in a wild card series. I don't think we should have lost. 010, we had a good year. And then we kind of rebuilt a little bit after that and had really good years in 15 and 16. I think you got to churn rosters there a lot more than they've ever had the desire to do, almost like a Tampa model, because you just players were down physically there. You got to trade your Arenados and Stories and guys like that at the top of their value, not right before they're going to become free agents. And I think you need to draft and develop exceptionally well there. But I do think you need to probably churn your rosters there, even a lot more than I did or I was allowed to do.
Yeah, similar to those guys you mentioned, those Arenado stories. Was there one specific decision that you were most proud of while you were either in Colorado or even Cleveland when it comes to draft picks, free agency, something along those lines?
I've been blessed to be a part of unbelievable draft picks where I played an integral role. Maybe not like signed the guy to the contract, but from Manny Ramirez to Jim Thome, I mean, they go on and on. I mean, it's a long history of just being really, really fortunate to be able to be a part of watching some incredibly talented players. And I would say that drafting and developing players for me is the most joy that I got within the game. Some GMs will talk about trades they made at the big league level. I never had a ton of money to work with, so, or free agent signs. Again, I never had a ton of money to work with, so my focus was always just on, that part of the game, which I, to this day, I still am extremely passionate about.
So would you, how would you compare like Arenado? Like I'm a huge Nolan Arenado fan. How would you compare that drafting to, anyone else that you've been
Well, he
able
was an
to pick?
interesting pick. He was a kid out of Southern California. He was a non-athletic shortstop that did not hit for power. And so what our people, Bill Guyvette, I give a ton of credit to, who was my assistant GM. He went in and had a private workout with Nolan, and he let me know, listen, he's not going to play shortstop. We're going to have to move him to either third base or catcher. He's got incredibly strong arm. His feet moves well for a non-athletic kid. And he said he has no power right now, but he never swings and misses. And I'm a big believer that if a kid has great bat-to-ball skills and finds his barrel on a consistent basis, the power will come as he physically matures, learns to hit and plus counts. And then if he has the aptitude to make some necessary swing adjustments without being told. When Arenado got in our system, because he was a second round pick, he went to Grand Junction. I had an opportunity to see him play in a 5-game span. And I left there saying, this kid's going to be a superstar. Because he, like, I grew up a huge fan of Brooks Robinson. I was a third baseman myself, not a great third baseman, offensively, defensively, I actually was. And Brooks Robinson, he had an innate ability to move before the ball was hit. Like he had this instinct based upon the trajectory of the bat to the ball. And he was always like a step ahead of everybody else. Nolan had that same capabilities.
Wow.
And Nolan worked really hard, and he got really good instruction in our system. When he got with Jerry Weinstein in Modesto, it changed his whole career. Jerry is hard. And he made Nolan grow up, gave him discipline, gave him a routine. And I thought Nolan really started to take off there. There were moments of teetering for Nolan in the development process, but he's a tough kid, and I'm so proud of him and what he's been able to accomplish in his career. I can't say at times he probably liked me very much. I was really hard on him because I saw greatness in him, and I didn't want him to waste that. And I think that's probably the biggest frustration part of the job is when you see greatness in players and they don't work as hard as they possibly can to be great for themselves. Nolan didn't fall into that category. He worked hard to be a great. Trevor Story worked incredibly hard to be great. Matt Holliday worked incredibly hard to be great. All those guys. Troy Tulowitzki probably worked too hard to be great. Todd Helton was a tireless worker to be great, obsessive worker. And then there were some other guys that ended up having great big league careers, probably won't get into their names, that they enjoyed more of what the game gave them than to being as great as they possibly could be in the game.
Interesting. Yeah, because Arenado, of course, did develop that power. 341 career homers,
He's a Hall of Famer.
gold glove after gold glove after gold glove. If he doesn't
He's going
get
to
into
go in the
Hall of
Hall of Fame.
Fame.
Yeah, he's got to figure some things out. The game has got him a little bit the last 2 years, but I do think he'll figure it out.
I'm definitely gonna be able to bring that up because I don't know when, probably in the next couple of months, I'm going to do a podcast with Bob Nightingale. So
Great.
that'll be fun to
Awesome.
get his
Dear
perspective.
friend of mine. Great guy. Great baseball mind.
It'll be great to talk to a Hall of Fame voter, maybe see what he sees in those Hall of Fame things. Because if Nolan doesn't make it, even maybe first ballot, I will be pretty angry.
Well, I think his peak is unbelievable. Whether he'll make it in first ballot or not
He
will
needs to
depend
keep.
upon
He
he
needs to
needs
keep
to
going.
rebound from these last 2 years
Yeah.
and finish stronger than he has.
But if he
He's a
can.
very big environmental guy. I'm not sure the Cardinals are a great fit for him. He'd be great in a place like Philly, which he won't go. They already have a third baseman, or the Yankees. He'd be great the Dodgers. He'd be great in places that maybe he's not. Carrying the load, but he's in an environment where it's all about winning day in and day out.
I feel like the last 2 years, St. Louis kind of killed both Nato and Goldschmidt.
Yeah, both of them. And I love Paul. I mean, Paul's unbelievable, our first major investor in Wynn Reality. And I do think he's going to come back next year and shock people. I think he's going to have a great bounce back year.
I can sure hope so. Two legends of the 21st century, just hoping they can rebound and
Absolutely.
continue their Hall of Fame cases, because I think they both
Yep.
definitely should make it.
Yeah, I think it'll be a 1 year deal for Paul, but I think he's going to bounce back if he puts himself in the right situation and have a really, really good year.
Amazing. Just great. So, in regards to, major league and minor league players, I have had this question for a while. What's the thought process when you're deciding to either call up or send down a player to or from the major league roster? Is there a certain performance threshold, or is it just a feeling?
Yeah, you don't paint every decision with the same brush because every player innately is made uniquely different. We had a player development plan in place for every one of our players, both in Cleveland and Colorado. And so is both mental, physical, and fundamental. So it depends upon if they checked off all the list in their player development plan, then they graduated, so to speak, to the next level. The system has ch changed a little bit now. They rush players through dramatically. I think college baseball has gotten way more competitive. Players have done well at the big league level with little service time at the minor league level. So I feel kind of got mixed feelings on that, but I guess it's worked for some players. But I don't know over in the long run. I think what the minor league teaches you is how to fail and how to handle failure, how to succeed and how to handle success, and how to create a routine that allows you to be consistent no matter how much the game may challenge you. So I think when you run through not allowing them to establish those foundation, eventually catches up to you at some point in time.
Yeah, I have one final question from the GM standpoint. And that is, there's a common confusion as to the time frame between a player agreeing to sign a contract and the time the media gets it. Is that a consistent time frame? And how does it necessarily go about?
Well, first of all, you don't ever hide anything from the media anymore. It's like I used to get angry about it. Now I could care less. They just know so many people within the agent group or your front office. That's just the reality of the game. It really just gets down to timing, Jack. Believe it or not, just it's really based upon physicals. Where the player is, when you can get him in, how long will the physical take? Did you find anything in the physical that you want somebody else to take a look at? It really is just, you end up signing a letter of agreement with an agent group, or an agent directly, pending a physical, and then it's just a matter of logistics after that.
So there's no distinct time frame. It's just whatever the physical comes up with.
Yeah, it just depends upon, a player lives in Seattle, Washington, and he signs a contract with the Boston Red Sox. You want your own orthopedic group taking a look at that player. You're not going to outsource that to a group in Seattle. So that
Interesting.
player's got to get on a plane and go to Boston. Time frame's got to be set up. He's got to get MRIs done, full examination, blood work done, urinalysis done. He's got to get the whole kitchen and caboodle done. And then the orthopedic doctor has to review the results with your head trainer. And then they collaborate. If there's anything that's a red flag, they'll usually come to the GM and say, what do we want to do here? Do we need to get a second opinion? Then you make, if there's a problem, you let the agent group know that immediately, what's going on. And so it's just a matter of how clean the MRIs are, how long it takes to get the player in, et cetera, et cetera.
Wow, that's not the answer I was expecting. That's really cool, the whole physical
Yeah,
thing.
no, it's a process. And that's why I always caution people, when you make a free agent sign, that's just that's 50% of it. The other 50% is you got to clear all the other obstacles and hurdles to make sure that everything is clean and you're ready to go, because you're usually investing an awful lot of money into a situation where you've got a long-term relationship in place. You got to dot the I's and cross all your T's.
That's super cool. I have three questions left. Two more from maybe just like an MLB analyst perspective, and then one more from your time with Win Reality. And the first one is, how do you see MLB culture changing and expanding over time? Do you see things staying relatively traditional, or do you think players like Chisholm or Ellie De La Cruz start to bring the personalities out more, will become more mainstay?
I think it'll be always down the middle. There are players that are young players that have grown up in a traditional way of playing the game, don't show a lot of emotions. They're real professional. Like Lindor hits the home run in Atlanta on Monday. My God, I was jumping up and down, and yet he just calmly and coolly just rounded the bases like he's done this 1,000 times. And then you'll have other players that hit it, then they'll go crazy. So I think it's, for me, I always love that as long as it's authentic. I hated it when it was premeditated and I thought the player was doing it to get attention. Because I do think, you gotta act like you've been there before. And so I think it's just the personalities of the players. I think the game's doing a great job of letting those personalities come out. But I think it's, again, another thing where you're not going to paint everybody with the same brush. You're going to let people be who they are and their personalities and how they want to perform and compete. And I think that creates some really interesting dynamics within the game. I will say there's players like Chaz Chisholm that needs to perform better before he worries about his brand. I got on air a few years ago with Kelnick, Lafau was an exceptionally talented player. I saw him as a high school kid, but he was worried about his shoes and his brand and his batting gloves, and he hadn't even performed at all at the big league level. You got to perform. You got to earn the respect of being able to act a certain way by how you go out and perform every single day on the field. And if you act that way before you perform, then that's probably you're going to get humbled. Two types of players in the game, Jack. There's those that are humbled and those that are about to be.
Wow. Do you have a favorite player who, maybe shows personality a bit more, like Acuna or someone of
I'm
that
kind of
caliber?
agnostic. I kind of now in the game, I enjoy watching Aaron Judge play. I love watching Ohtani play. I love watching Freddie Freeman play and Mookie Betts. I love watching Jackson Merrill play. I mean, I just feel like he's
Ooh.
one of the best young players I have seen come along in a long time. I think he's a superstar. And so I love watching great players perform when the games count the most. And that's why I love postseason.
That's great. That's super cool. Yeah, I definitely am a big fan of, players showing off their personalities a lot. And I like the MLB's
Younger
policies so
generation,
much more than
absolutely.
NFL.
Yeah, and I thought the MLB network has bought out and done a really good job with that too.
NFL, like they'll go at their necks if they do any kind of celebration after a reception. But MLB is like, as long as you don't like directly insult somebody, you're pretty much fine.
Yeah, and if they do, then the game has a way of taking care of itself on the field too, between the players.
Oh, 100%. Another question regarding to, your analyst role. What do you think happened to those teams that maybe had high hopes entering the season but failed to make an impact, namely Rangers, Diamondbacks, the AL East teams that didn't make the playoffs, the Mariners? Like, what do you think happened there?
Okay, we'll just go one by one, and I got to run after this, buddy. So this
All
will
right,
be the last
great.
question, if it's okay.
That's fine.
I think it's really difficult to repeat in our game. I think it's that's why you just haven't seen a World Series winner back to back years. And so I think the Rangers case, they just had a ton of injuries. I think the Diamondbacks case, I think their starting pitching had residual wear and tear from the year before. I thought they had an offensive team that Mike had put together, Mike Hazen, that could have won the World Series. I thought their bullpen was fine, but I just truly feel like they ran out of steam from a pitching standpoint. I think their numbers will bear that the case. The Seattle Mariners, for me, were the most disappointing team in the game.
Yeah.
When you have that kind of starting pitching and you don't get a chance to get them in to the dance, that's really hard. But I will say to you that Seattle has the opposite challenge as Coors Field. The only time that team has really hit there when they had Griffey, Buehner, they had a run there, Edgar Martinez. I can go on and on. They played inside a dome.
Oh,
It's
yeah.
a run suppression ballpark. And their strikeout, I think they finished last in the game against in contact rates. They really have to figure out how to create a team that can consistently make better contact and don't strike out as much as they do.
The
And
down
if
year
they
from
don't,
Julio definitely didn't help.
yeah, well, but he strikes out a lot. So you're going to have to complement him with guys that have high contact rates. And I don't think Jerry did that this year. But it's a tough ballpark. It's a tough ballpark for another factor that you probably have not even thought of. They have more travel distance than any team in the game because they're so far out on the West
Oh,
Coast.
100%.
And that creates a physical wear and tear on their players through the course of the season. So they really have some challenging obstacles there, but they've got a great pitching staff in place. It's healthy. They've got more good arms. Their scouting and player development system, I think their scouting director and the director of player development, Andy McKay, are the best in the game. And so they got a lot of good young players coming. I think they should commit to those good young players, but I'd love to see them go out and add some players in the free agent market that just actually have a knack for barreling up the ball on a consistent basis, even if they don't have a ton of power.
Love it. Absolutely love it. Thank you so much again for hopping on
My
the
pleasure,
show.
buddy. I really appreciate doing this, and I wish you the best of luck in your career.
Thank you so much. Everyone, make sure to at least check out Win Reality and just check out
Oh, yeah.
his
Why don't we do
entrepreneur
it? Talk about
endeavors.
Win Reality. No, no, no.
Yeah.
I can't hang up without talking about Win Reality. So, Win Reality was a company I started with my son, Chris. Chris went to college at Dartmouth, got drafted after his junior year, played 6 years of minor league baseball, got as high as AAA with the White Sox. He was a catcher. And the one thing that both of us saw, both from my front office view and his playing view, was the one thing that no one taught was how to hit it, how to practice that game speed when you're not playing in the game. And the one kinetic chain of hitting that no one practiced was pitch recognition. So we formed a company called Win Reality. Win stands for what's important now. And it's a company that just focuses on the basic art of pitch recognition in a virtual reality world to make hitters better. Everybody uses our product from 8 years old up to big leaguers get better in our product.
College programs
We
too.
ton of college programs, ton of big league clubs. We've now come up with, we're created a mobile app, which will allow players to actually get some real life swing analysis done. We call it Swing AI. Their parents can take a picture of their child hitting in a game and download it, and we'll be able to analyze their swing and give them some pointers as it relates to things that we see that need to be doing better. And then hopefully they'll graduate into our Win Reality platform, which we know makes players better. So we have about 100,000 users at all different age levels. The company's doing exceptionally well, and I'm very proud of it because I have no doubt that if you use our product, you're going to get better.
Incredible. As you mentioned earlier, Goldschmidt was one of those guys who hopped in pretty quickly.
Yeah,
So
he used it in spring training, loved it, invested in our company, and I'm just proud of the fact that Paul is a believer in what we do and how we go about doing it.
love it. So if any ball players want some swing help, be sure to check out Win Reality. But again, Mr. O'Dowd, thank you so much for hopping on
Thank you,
this
Jack. I've
episode.
enjoyed it. And again, I wish you the best of luck, buddy.
It's an
Bye-bye now.
absolute honor. Thank you very
Okay.
much.
Bye-bye.
Adios. And thank you, everyone, for listening to this episode of the Playoff Push Podcast. I'm Jack Dobbins, and thank you, and have a great rest of your day.